I'm really actually very excuse me. I want to thank you for the opportunity. First of all, I want to thank everybody for coming. Secondly, I want to thank you for the opportunity of having this forum to share some ideas that I have on the topic. Because I, the truth of the matter is, I don't know of a better place than YU to do it. So, especially since I have a big chunk of my Stern classes here, so I want to give them credit for coming up. I took the van.
It was booked until like midnight, so we.
You took
the subway.
Wow. Okay. Sirus Nefesh. We'll be taking it into consideration in the final exam, and when grading the paper. All right. I think we're all always tantalized by the question of. To what degree is what we do and what we think influenced by the outside world? How many times have you heard it said that the Yiddish expression "Wie sie Christel sich, sie Yiddel sich," the Jews do just like whatever the Christians do, the Jews do. It's clear that when you go to Sephardic shuls, that the chants sound very Middle Eastern, and how many times have you heard it said that Ashkenazim are machmir and so on because they lived among Christians and Christians are ascetics and on and on and on and on, things like that. The truth of the matter is that I think sometimes, and this is what I really want to address myself to tonight, is that we treat the question of outside influence on Judaism from an incredibly superficial point of view, and a lot of historians treat the topic very, very superficially, as if to say that, okay, we found some outside influence, yay, you want to take it out of the paper, we're all excited, and that we've done our job, as if that's all there is to say. Sometimes we get very dismissive. Oh, that's not generically Jewish. That they got from somewhere else, and therefore it's not. And therefore, we can dismiss it. That got taken from this one, and that got taken from that one. And by picking everything apart and saying this is from here and this is from there, you're ostensibly left with nothing. Usually, people that want to be left with nothing are the ones who actually take that position. But this is the kind of thing that gets said. There are really three major approaches that I've been able to find. There are all kinds of variations in the middle about attitude towards finding outside influences on Judaism and on the way Jews function. There are those who are extremists in both directions. There were historians who literally just systematically go trying to find the outside reason for something happening. Okay, you find, for example, the great Jewish historian Yitzhak Ber, Fritz Ber, systematically would always try to find some kind of Christian connection to explain whatever phenomenon. So, for example, in his famous article about the origin of Hasidic Ashkenaz, he pegs the development of Hasidic Ashkenaz to the development of the Franciscan and the Dominican orders in the 12th century as part of the general spiritual revival that took place in Europe at the time. And that's it. That's all you need. Sometimes it's a little less blatant, but there are still many historians who find a Jewish something. They say, oh, the Christians do that. End of story. Finished. They're happy. On the other end, you have people who are more religiously conservative, whose position is there is no influence on the Torah, period. Jews went through history detached from everything else. That never happened. And by the way, this is not just in, this doesn't just happen in yeshivas and in places that one would expect it. My teacher, Professor Yitzhak Tversky, was singularly averse to people finding outside influence on Jewish sources and medieval writings. I'll never forget, I don't remember who the writer was, but somebody had mentioned that they found some kind of Greek source of a certain medieval philosopher, And some later came up and said, well, there was actually a Medrash like that also, and he was thrilled that they found the Medrash, because it's not possible. No influence if you can get away without and finding any influence, you shouldn't do it. I think they're both extreme, and I think they're both superficial points of view. I think that when we discuss Jews and Judaism exist in the world, even the briskers among us have to admit that when you come down from the rarefied world of conceptual learning and you have to paskin a shaila, you have to interact with the world, and somehow the absolute categories have got to adjust or have got to find their expression in the less than pristine and less than perfect world in which we live. And in that world, Jews lived, and in that world, it's inevitable that we should be influenced by our surroundings. So the question is not, is there influence? But the question is, what kinds of influence, how does it work, and where does it go? So in that connection, I think, again, that there are three different types of influence. And I think we should, I'd like to discuss them. The first is the easy kind. Okay? It's not really a no-brainer in terms of both in terms of theological point and halachic point of view. Things change. Life is dynamic. You're influenced. Professor Yisrael Tashma, Zichron Lebracha, once told me that he discussed this with Yaakov Katz. I don't mean to drop names, but Tashma used to love to drop names. He was talking about this with Yaakov Katz, and Yaakov Katz says, of course Jews are influenced. You have lunch, no? How many times a day do Jews eat in the time of Chazal? Twice. We eat lunch. Okay? That has a direct impact, by the way, on what? No? Shalashudas. Okay? Shalashudas is not such a big, I mean, it should be a big deal, but it's in terms of having an extra meal, okay? If you eat three times a day, it loses some of its valence, no? Okay? Changes in, you have certain changes in practice. Or there's another easy one. Okay, so the Torah says you're supposed to gird yourself at the loins. Why? Shema libo yirva yiras ha'erva. Right, guys have to wear a gartel. It's a halacha, right? You have to wear a gartel. So how come you don't wear a gartel? Anybody know? What? Yeah, but before we came up with elastics, there was Rashi. Reb Moshe Paskins, the elastic, you have the elastic, but there's, you know, like as I said, there was Rashi. Okay? I'm going to...
Hence also, I guess.
Yeah, well, pants is the issue. Coming up. It's not so we want. Maybe, yeah, maybe not. All right, so it's coming up. Okay, Beseda. All right, this you want to get that? This is a tshuva of Rashi. This is tshuva's Rashi Reish Samach Beis. Kosef b'tshuvos Ra'isi Pamachas says Rebbeinu, which is Rebbe Rashi. Shayam is Palil below Chagor. He wasn't wearing a gartel. Utavitamati v'amarti. Mazeshu is Palil below Chagor misnayim. Was on a gartel? What's going on? Hamrina b'gemar shasal adam is Palil below Chagor chalatzayim v'taima mishum lo libo reisa erva. Okay, v'amar. He says, "Kim du mali shivosana yamim lo hayalahem la chachamim mechnasayim." Correct. They used to wear robes and with a belt. Question: interesting question in terms of underwear. But anyways, and who invented? Who brought pants into the story? Once Jews moved to Northern Europe and they adopted certain Germanic customs, including pants. So this is the story. They built the pants so they shouldn't fall down. Okay, ela chalukeim gedolim ad samuch la'akevim, val kachol v'gadeim ayu stumim panim v'achor u'smol v'yamin. They wear a long, all enclosed gown. Leficha chayorim she'asel ispalel below azor. But now we wear pants, so you don't need to. Look at the last line. U'below shum azor yesh hefzik ben alev la'erva, because you have a belt, or you have the pants. Fartik. So a whole halacha goes the way of the world. Why? Because the circumstances change. We're influenced by the way we by the way we dress, and that affects us. Okay. Similarly, we're coming up to Pesach. All right? This is what a Seder used to look like. Okay, this is a Roman banquet. Okay, notice people are standing, people are lying on their stomachs. They have bread. What? Seder. So that, so you go on your side. So for purposes of a seba,
yes,
right, good. But you're eating on your stomach when you want to be basic. So you go to your left. So you should be makdim kodal leveshit. But you, the whole thing only works. The whole thing only works. A good. Okay. Seder. In any event, what the actual posture will be is not the issue. You have the table in front of you. You are on a bed or on a couch, and that's how you eat. Okay? That's a seba. Comes the Middle Ages. This is very not comfortable for those. This is a reconstruction of a typical medieval chair. The other one, this typical medieval chair, is not much better. Okay? But it's a major change in terms of the way people are sitting. Alright? And as a result, it's not for nothing. The Rav says, we don't have a seba anymore. So very simple. We're influenced by the world in which we live, and as a result, our practices change. That's a simple kind of influence. I don't think there's anybody who's going to really jump up and down and scream with regard to that. Where it gets sticky is when you find Jews and Christians, or Jews and Muslims, doing what is apparently the exact same thing at the exact same time. And you begin to wonder, is it possible? Is it probable that the two groups could be doing the same thing without having any kind of causal relationship between the two? It's in that kind of context, all right, that you often find, and it's usually the majority that influences the minority. That's normal, by the way. It's very abnormal for the minority to influence the majority unless there are special circumstances that obtain. Okay? Is it possible that, in fact, is it likely that there was influence? Okay? I want to give you a series of examples, and we'll see how it can cut actually both ways. In the year 1103, in the city of Rome, on the Trastevere, beautiful part of Rome, by the way. Those who've been to Rome, it's opposite the far side of the Tiber, opposite the big synagogue. Okay, in the Trastevere lived a man named Natan ben Yechiel Anav. Okay, Natan ben Yechiel Anav, his house is still standing today. Had a small yeshiva in the house, and he finished a work named the Aruch. What's the Aruch?
Dictionary.
It's the first Talmudic dictionary, certainly the first one written in Europe. Okay, it is organized by word, but incorporates a tremendous amount of material from all kinds of other word lists and so on. It is encyclopedic in aspiration, and is a very significant organization of information. Okay? It has not been studied extensively. There's only really one long article about the Aruch by the late Shrag Abramson, who, by the way, used to teach at Yeshiva periodically also when his son-in-law was learning for Smicha here. About 15 years ago, or maybe a little less, 12 years ago, Professor Tashma published an article in which he analyzed the background of the Aruch, asking himself the question, what brought the Aruch to write a dictionary? How come? Why? So he dug and he discovered that about 60 years before the Aruch, Christian scholar named Papias, P-A-P-I-A-S, had written a dictionary of Dash Encyclopedia called the Elementarium Doctrinae Rudimentum, the rudiments of basic doctrine. And it was 1041. And he argued that here you see that in Italy before the Aruch, you have sort of like collative activity that's done by a Christian, and there's no question that the Baal Aruch, the Rabbi Nachman ben Yechiel, who knew Latin, would have been aware of this book because he had contact with Christian intellectuals in Rome, and he must have been aware of it. He must have gotten his inspiration from there, because there were certain very similar structural similarities between the view. So here you have an ironclad case of one going to the of Christian influence leading to a development in the Jewish community. Okay, that's Tashma's take. I came back to the topic about 6 years ago on the occasion of, what was the occasion? Oh, I know, when we celebrated the 100th anniversary of Jastrow's dictionary. I didn't know that was one of these things. I thought we were celebrating 800 years from Rashi, but okay. Anyways, and I noticed something which is very, very... you know, which set off lights for me, and was the first warning sign and really got me into this issue. Sometimes if you want to know what influence is and how it works, you have to ask yourself not so much where things start but where they go. So I did a quick check. Where was the Aruch on the road of Jewish literature? And where was Papias's work? Okay. As it turns out, Papias wrote his book. It was a first effort in the direction of organizing and collating classical and Christian theological material. But there were many of those who followed. It started a movement which had been totally underdeveloped, if non-existent. Okay. So you have all kinds of other encyclopedias and dictionaries that get written increasingly through the 12th century and into the 13th century in Christian quarters, and Papias is one of the pioneers in that regard. I discovered this at a conference that I didn't go to. There was a conference on medieval encyclopedias and dictionaries that took place at Bar-Ilan on a January day in 1998, I think it was, and I couldn't go because we were snowed in Gush Etzion, and the people in Tel Aviv didn't believe that I couldn't get there because, you know, we were snowed in. But there was only three, and those of you who know, Israel only possesses three snowplows, and they're usually in the Golan. So we had to wait for to get out of Efrat the old-fashioned way by, you know, waiting for the snow to melt. So I couldn't make it, but I got the book, and I ended up reading the book, and in fact, I found out that in most Christian encyclopedic activity was a 12th century, 13th century business. When you look at the Aruch, it turns out that what the Aruch was doing was summarizing and collating everything that had accumulated till his time. In other words, the Aruch was actually marking the end of an era, not the beginning. So the significance of the action, okay, it's true. The who took the ball and ran with it was the man who died 2 years after the Aruch was finished in 1105. That's Rashi. But the Aruch was collating and putting and organizing most of the traditions of the Rhineland of the collective Perush of the Gemara that was developed in the Rhineland and also in Italy, including stuff from the Gaonim, and he was summing things up, as opposed to starting something new. So you have a situation as it might be, all right, that the form that the Aruch decided to adopt for his book came or was inspired by Papias's dictionary. But it would be the ultimate but certainly would be superficial at least to say that zekazeh, all right? We say zekazeh is an isser, you know, it's tamura, okay? You can't say zekazeh because the dynamic which led to each one was totally different. One starts something where there is something, where there isn't, and one ends something at the end of an era. Okay? So you might have maybe have a case of fluence, but the significance is of a totally reversed dynamic in each community. Okay? So that's a case where you have influence, but where the nuance makes all the difference. I'll give you another example along similar lines. In 1955, Ephraim Elimelech Orbach published the first edition. He had four other editions since then of his great work Balei HaTosafot, still unequaled as a biobibliography of the works of the Balei HaTosafot, everything under the sun. In his first chapter, in his discussion of Rabbeinu Tam, and at the end, he dangles in front of the reader he never quite says it, but the likelihood, he dangles the following situation. At the exact same time as Rabbeinu Tam is functioning in France, okay, in the same general area, a man named Peter Abelard is using dialectic to resolve contradictions and problems in Christian theology. Okay? Master dialectician, gets him into terrible trouble, Abelard. Well, he's also, Yetzirah gets him in trouble too. But also gets him to sing soprano for the rest of his life. But he's using dialectic to resolve issues, and here Rabbeinu Tam is doing the exact same thing in terms of sugyas. He never quite says it, but you're left with the distinct impression that somehow Rabbeinu Tam there must be some kind of a connection. Okay. When the book was published in 1955, the reviews started coming out in 56, a lot of the critics were very upset, and Professor Twersky wrote a review, and what she said, what's he saying is that it's a zeitgeist, you're really breathing the same air, and it leads you to think critically. Make your conclusion, yes or no. The similarities are tantalizing. Similar similarities, he points out, with regard to the way that the Roman law was studied in the University of Paris as well and elsewhere. But he never quite, comes to the bottom line. Yaakov Katz says, you make up your mind. Does this come to tell us that there was influence, or is it a matter of you have two different communities which are interpreting their sacred texts in similar matter? What is it you want? But there is this sort of feeling around it, as Professor Yisrael Yuval said to me once, that Rabbeinu Tam and Abelard were sort of a tzemed chemed. They were sort of like sort of Bobbsey twins, to put it into colloquial terms. In his volume called Yeinam, Professor Soloveitchik points out, he says, Rabbeinu Tam didn't need Abelard. First of all, what is the likelihood that Rabbeinu Tam, sitting in Troyes and in Rameru, was exposed to the method of teaching in the cathedral school of Paris, where the entire discussion went on in Latin, and where the topic was Christian theology, which was not something which was really of tremendous interest to Rabbeinu Tam. Okay? I mean, if there was discourse between Jews and Christians in the 12th century, it was about what? In France? New Bible! Right? Rashbam, Rabbi Yosef Kara, Bechor Shor, that's what they're discussing. They're the Victorines. That's the Bible is the issue. But not, there was a certain amount of dialectic there, but it's not. That's not where they had common cause. So Professor Soloveitchik says very simply, he says, first of all, it was a possibility. But aside from that's my comment. But then he says, since when in fact does a Jew require Peter Abelard to learn dialectic? Okay? Anybody who opens a Gemara is exposed to dialectic. What's dialectic? Dialectic is when you have a sweep of vision and you see contradictions between sources which should not be contradictory, and you resolve or explain those contradictions in all kinds of different ways. That's dialectic. It's not just asking kashas and terutzim. It means where you have a clash of sources which are equally authoritative, and you use dialectic to resolve it. What Chazal did to the Torah, what the Tanaim or the Medrash Halacha does to the Tanakh, or especially to the Chumash, what the Amoraim do to the Tanaim. So now, the Balei Tosfos apply the method to the Gemara. So the question is not where did the method come from. The method grew from inside. The question is a question of timing. Okay. So ask ourselves the question: why now? How come the Christians are doing something similar? So let's first ask ourselves: is there anything indigenous before we start schlepping a million miles away and asking ourselves a question? Where did the method come from? How come that maybe it came from the non-Jews? Let's ask ourselves a simple question: What changed inside the Jewish world that might have caused this?
Rashi.
Okay. Up until if you read the literature about the parish of the way the yeshivas of Mainz and Worms, well maybe Worms a little bit less, but Mainz worked was they learned Keseder. Masechta after Masechta, they developed this sort of cumulative traditional commentary on the Gemara, and you learned it by heart and you took little notes, and what you learned in yeshiva you knew, and what you didn't learn in yeshiva you didn't know, and that's the way it worked. Okay? There was very little sense of the scope of the Gemara. What Rashi's commentary did was make the entire Shas available for a sweeping vision. You could see, take in the entire thing. It liberated. It democratized and liberated the study of Talmud from the need to go page after page, and all of a sudden exposed the work in its totality with all of its problematics. The next obvious step, through collation and contrast, was after contrast and contradiction is resolution. Okay? Interestingly, there's a in the 15th century, Rabbi Joseph Kolon Marik notes a tradition that he observes that the most of the dialectical sugyas in Shas date from the generation of Abayan Verov. He raises the issue in the context of the question of Halacha Kabasroi. I don't want to go into the details right now. But he notes that in the time of Abaye Verov, up until the time of Abaye Verov, everybody studied under one or two teachers, and you had all the traditions, and that was it. You studied with this guy, this guy, this guy. That's who you belong to. In the time of Abaye Verov, he says, they started collating traditions and analyzing them, comparing and contrasting and so on, and all of a sudden the full panoply of traditions became available, and mimela questions arose and the requirements of resolutions became necessary. In a word, the Talmudic dialectic, Talmudic pilpul, is born as a result of an act of collation. In fact, you know, there's a big debate between Professor David Weiss Halivni and others as to when the famous Stam of the Gemara, which is the most dialectical, the most pilpuli sugyas, when they date. Professor Halivni dates them very late. But as we sit right now, there is somebody working on a doctorate under Halivni's guidance, which is really, you know about this? Okay, under Halivni's guidance, arguing the Marik's position. That in fact, that the Stama is early and dates from the time of collation and contrast. All right. The point is, it seems to be, it's pretty, it's very logical. Only when you compare and contrast, you start seeing contradictions and nuances, and then dialectic will grow. So once, why Rashi's commentary was only written then is another issue. But it's a fact that the minute that Rashi, that within a generation after Rashi's Perush was published, Rabbeinu Tam, under the inspiration of Rabbeinu Tam's own genius, dialectic is reborn. You don't need to go outside the Dalai Lamas of the Jewish community to account for that. But the truth of the matter is that the same thing is happening in both camps. So here, I think it's not that far to say. Sometimes similar circumstances do lead to similar results. As it happens, the second half of the 11th century, the first half of the 12th century, is a period in which within Europe, okay, with the exception of the Crusades, is a big exception, within Europe things are much more stable. A lot of the more violent elements in society have left the area because they're going to the Drang Nahostan, they're going down the Crusade, they go to Spain, whether we Conquista, whatever the case might be. And you have the kind of composure to be able to sit down quietly and collate. So similar circumstances certainly can lead to similar results. But you don't have to go running to a question of influence. Sometimes it's a little bit more nuanced. In the book that I just went to the editor, my book, I spent a lot of time talking about the status of the synagogue in medieval Ashkenaz. Okay, and my basic argument there, and I published it in several places, is that Ashkenazim, more than anybody else, treated the shul as a base of mikdash. Yes, we know about Mikdash Ma'at. Everybody held that the shul is a Mikdash Ma'at. But the question is not whether, but to what degree. And as far as the Ashkenazim were concerned, the shul was 99 and 44, 100% base Mikdash. Okay, and that's all kinds of proofs that people used to bow down when they came in and bow down when they came out and all kinds of things. Okay, what I would like to... But one of the points of...
Can you say that that's a Christian influence in itself? When you go in, don't they go in, kneel, cross themselves when they come in, and when they go out, kneel, cross themselves?
Hold that thought for a minute, okay?
Wouldn't it be more likely that was just the ancient practice of carryover?
Come again?
Wouldn't it be more likely that was an ancient carryover?
Just as... First of all, bowing when you go into a sacred place is actually a natural thing to do. It's something which suggests itself, but hold that thought just for a minute. You could say that, okay, and you could argue, as some scholars have argued, that the synagogue serves as a contra to the cathedral. Except, as I've shown and as Professor Tashma showed before, that there is not one, almost no element in this idea of a very close identification, almost full identification of the synagogue with the Beis HaMikdash can be traced back to Eretz Yisrael in the post Talmudic era, if not before. I'm just going to throw out one example which is very tangible. How many doors were there in the Beis HaMikdash? How many gates? According to the Medrash, there were three. There was the main gate and there were two gates on the side. One was for Avelim, and one was for Chasanim. Okay? If you take a look at the front of the major of the Talmudic era synagogues in Eretz Yisrael, they all have three gates. Okay, just an example. We know that many of the basic furnishings of the shul that we have in Ashkenaz are already present, are already quoted by the Medrash as occurring in Eretz Yisrael. In terms of many other things, for example, being careful to mitahara, all kinds of things like this are already testified to earlier. So it's clear that you're talking about a tradition which accompanies the Jews from Eretz Israel to Italy to Germany. Okay, now at the same time, so there's no reason to think it's not endogamous. Okay, At the same time, there's no question that the Jews perceive the cathedral and the church, if it wasn't such a big town, as the anti, as the other, as the threat. Okay? And there is no question, and as a result, there is no question in my mind, okay, that in fact they saw the shul, if the shul was their response emotionally to the church, especially since the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash is consistently thrown up to the Jews as a sign of divine displeasure. The fact that the shul is a portal of sorts of Beis HaMikdash is a way of responding to the Christian, to the implicit Christian challenge. Okay? So here you have a situation in which you have an endemic internal Jewish phenomenon which fills a contemporary need as an added bonus. You following? In other words, it would have been a Beis HaMikdash anyways. It would have been Jewish sacred space anyways. But because of the feeling of needing a contra to the cathedral, it takes on that added significance. Okay? I think this becomes even more clearly understandable in light of something which I which well, the article's not out yet, but if you don't quote it, then I'll tell you about it. The Jews in Ashkenaz seem to have believed that the Shechina in Melotif Arta appeared in the Beis Knesses. Now, obviously, God is everywhere, and you always pray towards the Shechina. Fine. But there is this added sense of the potency of the Shechina in Shul, which is something which is really very unique to Franco-German Jewry. And I have a number of proofs of this, but the best one is this: the Mishnah in Megillah says, all right, that you're not supposed to let a kohen before Kohanim used to cover their heads with the talisim. Okay, you're not supposed to let a kohen who has disfigured hands or stained hands to dufen. Why? Mipnei sha'am mistaklim bo. People look at it. What's the problem? All Rishonim, across the boards. And when they found the Rishonim, they brought the Rishonim. It's so you shouldn't be distracted and concentrate on the hands and not think about the bracha. Rashi quotes the Gemara Chagiga. No! Because it's also to look at the Shechina, and Misha Mistakel B'Shechina Ke'ein of Ke'os, you'll go blind. And all Rish, and the Tosfos jump all over Rashi. So we're talking about that's only the Beis HaMikdash. It's only the Beis HaMikdash. What are you talking about? The full potency of the Shechina does not exist in the shul. It's only in the Beis HaMikdash. It's got to be because of Hesach Hadas. It's got to be because of being distracted. Okay? I don't care about the Yerushalmi right now. Why did Rashi say it? And Rashi wasn't the only one. The Raivan says it. And the Raivan's brother, Rabbi Chizkia, is quoted the same, along similar lines in the Rokeach. Okay? And obviously there were a lot of people who have felt that way, and the Balei Tosfos said it was necessary to argue against it, because one of the manuscripts of Rashi's Perush on Megillah was fixed by one of the Sofrim. The Sofer quotes Rashi and says, but I don't really mean it. It's really only Beis HaMikdash, we all know that. This guy couldn't control himself. If you want to look at the text, it's in Aaron's critical edition of Rashi's Perush on Megillah. Okay, so what does that tell you? What does that tell you? That this is what people believe. And the truth of the matter is, when you were kids, why don't you look at the hands of the Kohanim? Because you'll go blind by looking at the Shechina. All Sephardic Rishonim don't quote this. In fact, the Ritva, the Rajma rather, was so upset with it, he says, Rashi Perush Binyan Acher. He couldn't even quote it. He wouldn't even say, you know, Rashi said like this, but I don't say like that, but I disagree. And the Ritva ignores it totally. Now, if you know the Ritva, how loyal he is, because this is quoting Rashi, all of a sudden, no Rashi. But you see, it was a very strong idea. Now, Lahavdil Elef Havdalos, at the exact same time, Christians cultivated, intensively cultivated, the idea of a very strong appearance of the, of divinity in the church, especially at the time of the central sacrament. Okay. Abelard, in fact, Abelard, when he writes to Heloise on one occasion, prays that when she and her nuns pray, blesses them, that when she and her nuns pray, when Heloise and her nuns pray, that the divinity should appear in his full majesty to their prayers. All right? So I don't think that this idea that the Shekhinah is shown, by the way, it's 60 years before, that's 60 years after Rashi. I think exactly what's going on here is very simple. You have an internal development, but when the Christians talk about God appearing, a divinity appearing in the church, the belief, the conviction that the Shekhinah in full potency appears in Shul serves to reinforce their own sense of uniqueness. And enhances the significance of what is an endogamous belief. Finally, there's a third kind. There are cases where it's clear that things are taken from the outside world and brought in. Okay. The classic example is the systems of penance that were developed by the German Pietists, by Hasidi Ashkenaz, especially by Rebbe Lezer Rokeach. Especially the one that we know is what? Tshuvas HaMishkal. You know, that you did this, you have to do this, you do this. The whole idea of penance and bringing yourself onto penance, that's very bad English. Committing yourself to an act, to a penitential act, as part of fasting 40 days and rolling around in the snow, and I mean the yantels, the whole nine yards. Okay, it's not easily elicited from Talmudic reference. It's Professor Berger, I think in his, as it just came out in English, in an article that he published in a volume called Mul Hatzlav, Betel Hatzlav, in the Shadow of the Cross about the Crusades. Notes that sometimes Jews were actually very strongly challenged by real Christian piety and Christian penitential literature, which really flowered in the late 12th, 13th century. Okay, posed a serious challenge to Jews because generally you can make light of all kinds of things, but here you have people that are really forcing themselves to suffer in order to be able to expiate their sins. That's a serious issue, and it could very well have led a sensitive pietist to say, that can't be that we don't have something like that. Okay? So from the outside, it's fairly clear that many elements of this specific kind of penitence were actually imported. But again, that's not the whole story. Number one, it is a given rule of in sociology of religion that you are not influenced, that religions and communities are not influenced until there is an interior need that influence fills. Number one. Okay? So you don't stam get influenced. If you have a need, you fill it. Number two, the fact that you're influenced by the outside world is no chiddush. The question is, what gets absorbed? And how does it get regularized? How does it get Judaized? How do you understand this behavior? And in the case of Tshuvat HaMishkal, they found Gemaras, they found Psukim, because there's an inner conviction that if it's good, it must have been in the Torah. Well, it wasn't just like that, which is the impression you would get. And plenty of things didn't get in because they weren't appropriate. And that's a very important thing to note. Judaism is not a sieve. It doesn't just let everything in to the degree that things do get in. Which leads me to my last point. There is, and I said it was going to be religious considerations. There is a big debate, I'm sure you're aware, about the question of around the issue of what's called the essentialism. Anybody know what essentialism is? Essentialism in biology and in anthropology and religion and history is the question of whether groups or things have a basic essence which doesn't change. It had been very popular and very pretty established moment in terms of history, in terms of national identity and so on, until the onslaught of identity politics and post-culturalism and so on, where, for example, Simone de Beauvoir said, I was born a female, but I was socialized to be a woman. Okay, being a woman is not something which you're born with, or being a man, it's something which society imposes on you. It's a very Marxist kind of position. So to be an essentialist today is to be incredibly not politically correct. However, that doesn't mean it's wrong. On the contrary, if something's not politically correct, it's probably the best argument that it's right. Certainly on a lot of issues. I believe that however it plays itself out, there is such a thing as a Jewish essence. There is such a thing as the integrity of Jewish tradition. It may not always look the exact same, but there is some kind of a core, some kind of a consistency which unifies us both laterally and horizontally. And that should be kept in mind in several different contexts. Number one, on the question of influence. Not everything gets in. Things that get in have to be adjusted. Things have to be adapted to fit basic Jewish values. Okay, number one. And those values are there. They're text-based, they're intuitive-based, they're mimetically based, to use the word everybody likes to use now. Whatever the case might be. But there is a Jewish essence, and not everything goes. And sometimes you can have a nuanced situation, as I said, where what? On the one hand, you may have an internal development which may serve an outside purpose too, or may respond to it, or add extra meaning to it in response to an outside situation. But that doesn't deny the existence of some kind of internal Jewish integrity. That observation is especially important in light of two articles which I read the past week, which is literally. They've upset me no end. One appeared in the last issue of Azure, which is published by the Mishalem Center, and the other one hasn't been published yet. It's been published in the next version of Akadamot. The first article was published by a woman named Evelyn Gordon, who's a wonderful critic of the Israeli judicial system. Brilliant woman, together with a woman named Hadassah Levy, who is the editor of Jewish Ideas Daily, who also does incredible work. But this article was really problematic for reasons I'll tell you. And the second article is by a guy whose name I can't remember right this minute, who learns in Gush, and who got haskamas from some very serious Rosh Yeshiva in Gush. One article talks about the fact that the rabbis made all kinds of adjustments to halacha in order to adapt to the post-destruction period, and therefore the rabbis should get their act together and should make all the changes we need to in terms of conversion and stuff like that to save Jewish people. And the other article is arguing that when it comes to a mezumin, it doesn't matter whether it doesn't have to be just three men, it could be two women and one man, however it works. What distressed me about both, I think they're both wrong. In my opinion, I mean, I know in this I would be disagreeing with very serious people, but I was not. I have serious reasons to be to disagree. In both cases, what I feel is missing is any sense of the integrity of halacha. In both cases, it's a matter of we can do what we want. There's no internal anything. You can pull out a Rishon, you can pull out of this, and pull out of that, and wherever it goes, it goes. Um, It's not possible to quantify something like Masorah, integrity, or system. You can't quantify it. It's a secondary characteristic in terms of modern philosophy, but it doesn't mean it's less there for its inability to quantify it. Modern philosophers can't quantify red. Well, they can quantify it, but you can't. When they give you the formula for red, you can't see it. You just see red. Maybe that wasn't the color to pick. Something soothing, cobalt. Okay. Similarly, there is it to assume that the halachic system lacks an integrated series of emotions and deferences and devotion to text and submission to what the written Masorah tells us, as well as the ability to be able to mechadesh, I think is to actually ignore a fundamental element in the organic development of Judaism at large and halacha in particular. So that when we talk about influence, that reality, and it is protean, it changes, okay? That reality is critical if we're going to not distort the way that the Torah functions, that Judaism functions in the world, both in the past and in the present, and by extension, hopefully, in the future. Thank you.